Iran's foreign minister calls for concrete steps toward the elimination of weapons of mass destruction. Ukraine says the situation in Bakhmut is extremely tense as Russian troops step up their offensive to bring the eastern city under their control. And the U.S. joins Canada and the European Union in imposing a ban on the Chinese video sharing social networking service TikTok. And welcome to World News, coming to you from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says promoting international and regional peace and security hinges on the elimination of weapons of mass destruction. Amir Abdullahian was addressing a UN conference on disarmament in Geneva. The top Iranian diplomat expressed regret that the countries possessing nuclear weapons have failed to abide by their disarmament obligations. Those states, he added, have continued to enlarge their nuclear arsenals in defiance of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. He noted that countries with no nuclear arms should not be prevented from pursuing their peaceful nuclear programs. He said that Iran's initiative to rid the West Asian region of nuclear weapons has been blocked by Israel for years. In a separate meeting in the Swiss city, the top Iranian diplomat addressed the 52nd regular session of the UN Human Rights Council. Well, podcaster and journalist Esa Krishnaswamy says Western countries abuse human rights whenever they deem necessary.
So Western countries have always abused the issue of human rights. That's the first thing they stick to. With Iran, they're claiming it's women's rights. But under the Shah that the Western government supported, women's literacy rate was only 35.48% in 1976. So it's clearly a political tool. And yesterday I was listening to Antonio Gutierrez's speech. And he mentioned Russia's human rights violations in Ukraine, but he did not mention the ghastly happenings on the Ukrainian side for the past 7 years in the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. For example, I've written an article about this. Ukraine deployed fascist battalions known as the Tornado Battalion that did every atrocity known to man. I personally have witnessed mass graves in Luhansk. People have been tortured. And all of these are just what was not addressed in his speech. So I am very skeptical that this will be a forum to be more neutral. Another example is, of course, the women's rights in Afghanistan, where the U.S. uses it as a cudgel right now, but they've had 20 years to improve women's rights. So, yeah, it seems like as long as the U.N. is in the current condition with the world order that was created right after World War II, human rights will always be a cudgel as opposed to a genuine concern on the rights of humans.
Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has met with several high-ranking officials on the sidelines of the UN Human Rights Council session. Earlier on Tuesday, he held talks with the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths. Our correspondent, Gisu Misha Ahmadi, now join us from Geneva to give us more information. Good to see you, Gisu. Well, fill us in on what took place today.
Well, actually, bilateral meetings and a pentalateral meeting took place with the minister and the humanitarian organization, including the International Committee of the Red Cross, were present here to discuss humanitarian issues that are important on the agenda. Were three key issues which also brought up during the bilateral meeting with Martin Griffiths. First of all, the issue of Syria. Right now, at the moment, you know that the quake hit Syrians have a very hard time receiving international aid because of the sanctions that have been imposed on the country. Also, the situation in Yemen that is considered a textbook example of a humanitarian crisis. This is the way the UN describes the situation in Yemen. And of course, Martin Griffiths said that he was very sad, and it was sad to see that the call for financial aid did not receive as much response as they had expected. And it seems that the world even differentiates between who to help and who not to help. Also, another key issue that was brought up during this meeting was the Afghan refugees in Iran. Nazia, I'd like to draw your attention to this issue. There are more than 5 million Afghan refugees currently living in Iran. And unfortunately, because of the sanctions, Iran, although it has been hosting these Afghan refugees for decades, and even recently the number has increased, it has not been receiving any international or foreign aid regarding the situation. And this was one of the main topics brought up by the Iranian foreign minister. And of course, Martin Griffiths agreed. And actually, it was a very positive meeting, the way that those who attended it have described as I talked to them. And they are hopeful that there might be some actual steps and measures to be taken to alleviate the situation. Also, like I said, the situation in Syria and Yemen were also high on the agenda, and they were discussed in detail with Martin Griffiths.
All right, thank you so much for that update. Out of Geneva, that's Gisu Misha Ahmadi. Moving on to other news now this hour. Massive air drills are underway in Iran to assess armed forces' response to possible attacks on the country's key defense and nuclear installations. Now, the air defense units of both the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps are taking part in the joint exercises. The drill's spokesman says on the first day of the maneuvers, the air divisions detected hostile objects and use electronic simulation to intercept them. Brigadier General Amir Abbas Alamdari added that they also practice establishing safe multi-layered communications with the Integrated Air Command and Control Network to make timely decisions in the event of threats. Now, the Army and the IRGC are using indigenously made systems and weapons that cover more than 1 million square kilometers of Iranian airspace. Russia has announced that it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty called the New START. Moscow suspended its participation last week. We've discussed that in depth with our guests in our news review program.
Russia says it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty until the West changes its attitude toward Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman said that NATO has now turned into Russia's enemy by arming Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov added that the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of the security of another. Last week, President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's decision to suspend the participation in the new START treaty. He cited Washington's failure to keep its end of the bargain and its deepening involvement in the Ukraine war. The U.S. called the move deeply unfortunate and irresponsible. The new START treaty was signed between the U.S. and Russia in 2010. Puts a limit on nuclear devices and the means of their delivery. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Moscow. We also have Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, joining us from Oslo. Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, let me first start with you. When it comes down to this new START treaty, Russia is being blamed for pulling out of it, but when you take a look at the reasons as to why it did that, especially the explanation given by the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and given what's happening in the Ukraine conflict, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, it's a dire signal, no matter how you look at it. You know, we did grow up in a world where the two big nuclear powers, who have like over 90% of the nuclear weapons, had subscribe to processes of arms control, all kinds of verification procedures, back channels for communications and crisis management. All that has been going out the window for almost 20 years. And it's mainly the American side that has abolished treaties. I mean, they've pulled right out. several, from the ABM Treaty to the INF Treaty, the Open Skies. The Russians haven't actually pulled out of the treaty. They've suspended their participation. But it is a warning that things are getting that bad. They don't want to continue with the verification process, which is the main feature, you know, the visits to military installations by the other side to check and count and do all that. That's all gone. And nobody can cheer. I mean, absolutely nobody can say this is a good thing. But you can see why they're doing it. And I think that they're doing it to warn the Americans that it can't be business as usual in some areas where the Americans want it to be, and all this other stuff with Ukraine going on the other hand.
Well, Glenn Deason, if it's supposed to be a warning, like our guest there says, are the Americans heeding any warnings coming from Russia? It looks like it's just on deaf ears.
Well, so far, we appear to be stuck in this escalation spiral, and I think the Americans understand the severity of this because the arms control agreements have been collapsing one after another. Now, yes, it's correct that it's the United States that unilaterally pulled out of, you know, everything from the ABM Treaty to the INF agreement, Open Skies. So this is this is quite problematic. But and I think the Americans realize that this is a disaster. Correctly argued before, everyone loses here. This is the last remaining agreement, and especially in this situation, we need more transparency. But obviously, the reasons why Moscow pulled out also are quite understandable. I mean, not canceling the agreement, but suspending it, because they, of course, are reluctant to have the United States around, around their strategic nuclear weapons at this point in time. Keep in mind that the Engels air base in Russia has been attacked twice by Ukrainian drones. And there's good reasons to believe that both the drones, the funding of the drones, the intelligence from in terms of how the drone should approach the airbase, there's good reason why all of this would have been supplied by the United States. I'm not saying it necessarily was, but there's good reasons to do so. So given that NATO and Russia now are like de facto in war, it's quite reasonable to suspend it, to suspend inspections. But I hope that this is something that the West, especially then the Americans, are taking quite seriously, because there is a need to de-escalate at some point and get these agreements back on track. And I'm happy that Moscow hasn't ruled it out and only suspended it, so we can return to this agreement.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank Fred Weir, political analyst from Moscow. Thank you. And Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Well, the Russian military has intensified its attacks on the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region to take control of it. According to Ukraine's military, the Russian army has surrounded the city in a bid to force Ukrainian troops to surrender. Ukrainian commanders say the situation there is extremely tense due to constant Russian shelling and the attempt to cut off supply lines. Meanwhile, the Russian army said it had targeted an ammunition depot and shot down U.S.-made rockets and Ukrainian drones. Now, the capture of Bakhmut would pave the way for Russian forces to take control of the last remaining urban areas in the region. The Kremlin has reiterated its position on Ukraine, saying Russia is open to negotiations to end the conflict. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, however, that new territorial realities could not be ignored. He said Russia would negotiate if Kiev accepted Moscow's control over the four annexed Ukrainian regions. Late last year, Russia annexed Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson after people in those regions decided in a referendum to join the Russian Federation. Kiev and its Western allies have rejected the votes as a sham. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterates his plea to his Western allies to provide his country with fighter jets to defend its skies.
Our pilots and anti-aircraft units and other experts of our Air Force are doing a great job, but we will be able to completely protect our skies when the aviation taboo is fully lifted in relations with our partners.
Zelensky's request to shore up his country's air forces comes as the West remains undecided to provide Kiev with warplanes. Ukraine has been given billions of dollars in its wars. The U.S. and some European countries also announced to Kiev with their has said that it will send an additional $1.2 billion in financial aid to Kiev. The announcement was made by the U.S. Treasury Secretary during her visit to Ukraine. Janet Yellen said the U.S. would also press for more action from its allies to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. Washington has been the biggest supplier of arms to Kiev since the war broke out. Well, the United States has joined Canada and the European Union in imposing a ban on the Chinese video sharing social networking service TikTok. The White House says federal agencies have been asked to remove and disallow installations of the application on devices operated by their staff. Now, the deadline is set to comply with an order issued by Congress. Now, the ban excludes businesses not associated with the federal government or the millions of private citizens. Canada and the EU have also banned TikTok from their devices. TikTok, which have 1 billion users globally, has rejected the accusations of sharing data with the Chinese government. China has also accused the U.S. of overstretching the concept of national security and abusing state power to suppress foreign companies. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Anti-war protesters have recently gathered outside major American airbase in EU. Demonstrators descended on the Ramstein military installation in Germany, calling for an end to Western arms deliveries to Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, several hundred people gathered recently outside the Ramstein U.S. air base in southwestern Germany to demand an end to weapons shipments to Ukraine. The military site is where Western officials have regularly held meetings over the past year to coordinate their aid to Kiev. The demonstrators also called for a cessation of hostilities and peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. They chanted the slogans and beat drums with an assortment of banners seen during a live stream of the event on YouTube, including some flags. The placards called for the Americans to go home and also featured slogans including freedom to Julian Assange, and stop the weapons deliveries. When the rally organizers notified the local authorities several days before the event, they said they expected it to kick off at midday and conclude with around 2,000 attending. According to RT, Ramstein Air Base has repeatedly made headlines since Russia launched its special operation in Ukraine a year ago. It's where the U.S.-led Ukraine Defense Contact Group has held its meetings aimed at shoring up the Ukrainian military. The last such gathering took place on January 20th. Recently, tens of thousands of demonstrators turned up in central Berlin for the Uprising for Peace protest, organized by prominent left party politician Sahra Wagenknecht and author Alice Schwarzer. They too denounce Western arms deliveries to Kiev and call for peace negotiations between the warring sides. Earlier this month, approximately 10,000 people took to the streets of Munich for a similarly themed rally just outside the Bayer Seehof Hotel, where world leaders convened for the Munich Security Conference. Further military support for Ukraine was among the topics high on their agenda. Among the speakers addressing the crowd was former Christian Democratic MP Jürgen Totenhofer, who argued that we have to serve peace and not the Americans. Much like the latest event outside Ramstein Air Base recently, the demonstrators in Munich also called for American troops to leave Germany. Meanwhile, according to Helsinki Times, last week hundreds of protesters gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the March Against the War Machine rally, which featured several prominent speakers, including former U.S. presidential candidates. The speakers accused Joe Biden of pushing the world to the brink of nuclear disaster by supporting Ukraine militarily, and called for an end to such support in favor of diplomacy. Former U.S. Congresswoman and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard warned that the proxy war in Ukraine against Russia could turn into a direct conflict between the United States, NATO, and Russia with catastrophic consequences. She criticized those who speak of how we're gonna fight and win as if a war with a nuclear-armed country could ever be won. Whether intentional or accidental, there is only one destination for such war, and that is a nuclear disaster, she said. Former Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein called for slashing the Pentagon's enormous budget, arguing that the $100 billion spent to support war in Ukraine could help mitigate a whole range of domestic problems, including lack of health insurance, homelessness, student debt, and medical debt. Former Congressman Dennis Kucinich demanded accountability from the U.S. government for its illegal and unconstitutional means to destroy the energy resources needed to protect millions of people in Europe during the winter, and then profited from its illegal actions by selling energy to Europe at a markup. He also criticized the U.S. government's misinformation and disinformation campaigns to incite fear and hatred among people. exciting partisan divisions at home and stirring ancient hatreds abroad. Veteran U.S. Congressman and former U.S. presidential candidate Ron Paul claimed that a simple way to stop wars is to end the Fed and not send people to war unless they vote for it. He also criticized the middle class and poor for paying for wars that only benefit the wealthy. The March Against the War Machine rally was held almost 1 year after the start of hostilities between Russia and Ukraine. The speakers called for an end to the war, an end to military support for Ukraine, and a redirection of the Pentagon budget towards domestic issues.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. During this month of Sha'ban, the month of Almighty Allah's mercy and pleasure, we will try to offer a glance into some of the passages of the whisper prayer of Sha'baniya, or the so-called Munajat Sha'baniya. Thank you in advance for staying with us. We'll be back again after listening to some parts of it.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك وكما أردت أن أكون كنت فشكرتك بإدخالي في كرمك ولتطهير قلبي من أوساخ الغفلة عنك.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the whispered prayer of Sha'baniyya. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك. My Lord, I had no strength to desist from your disobedience except when you awaken me for your grace because of your favor and grace. We said that regarding this part of the whispered prayer of Sha'baniyya, we are going to talk about one of the most important instances of Almighty Allah's favor, which is His love. Hubb, al-hubbu lillah, and also hubbullah, the love of the servant for the Almighty Allah, and the fact that the Almighty Allah loves His servants back. Now, as we were explaining in the previous episode, we said that a true wayfarer needs different kinds of things in his path towards perfection, towards ma'rifah and recognition of the Almighty Allah. We mentioned a wide range of elements appearing in the Holy Quran and also reflected in the traditions, like رجاء خوف تذرع تذلل حب تبتل استرحام استغفار طاعة عبودية ذكر and فقر and fasting, other things. We mentioned many things. But the point is that the one who wants to make his way toward Allah, he should not confine himself to a single path. This is because each of these paths has its own kind of aroma. And the point is that in the journey towards Almighty Allah, this kind of taste, this kind of aroma that can be found in this path is not something to be understood in the other path. The true wayfarer has to understand this fact. So, as a result, Islam presents a kind of pluralistic basis for the establishment of relation with Allah. However, this is a very wide topic, and we do not intend to discuss all aspects at this moment. But what we wanted to establish here is the fact that the relationship of the servant with the Almighty Allah must be based on very different elements. A wide range of elements are involved in this case. And hub is one of them. Love of the Almighty Allah is one of these elements that we are going to elaborate on and discuss in details from now on.
Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. حَفَفْتَهُ بِالرَّحْمَةِ وَالرَّضْوَانِ. Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat al-Sha'baniyya. The late Imam Khomeini in many places on several occasions emphasized on this Munajat, and in one of his sayings he said that there are many important mystical points that one can understand from the Quran and whispered prayers of Imams. And then in particular, he mentioned Munajat al-Sha'baniyya, and he said philosophers, mystics may be able to understand some aspects of these whispered prayers. But if someone wants to really understand, must be a person who has himself achieved a high level of closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that he can have a taste, he can have an experience of what he says. In another place, the late Imam Khomeini said something very important. He said, this Munajat al-Sha'baniyya is one of the whispered prayers that if someone pays attention to it and follows it and reflects on it, he can reach somewhere. He can achieve some levels of perfection. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us in this month of forgiveness and to be pleased with us in this month of pleasure. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us, our families, our community, all humanity with His pleasure, with His reward, with the coming of Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, with forgiveness, with being able to remain always on the right path.
So we said that there is a wide range of elements that make up the correct form of relation with the Almighty Allah. The servant has to taste all of them. He should not confine himself to one of these paths. The point is that it seems the best of these elements, the most powerful and the most efficient of them in binding one to Almighty Allah, in strengthening his relation with him, is the love of the Almighty Allah, is al-hubbu lillah. That's why, in this part of the whispered prayer of Sha'baniyya, we read, إِلَهِ لَمْ يَكُنْ لِي حَوْلٌ فَأَنْتَقِلَ بِهِ عَنْ مَعْصِيَتِكَ. My Lord, I had no strength to control myself from your disobedience, إِلَّا فِي وَقْتٍ أَيْقَظْتَنِي لِمَحَبَّتِكَ. Except when you awaken me for your grace. So, among the different forms of relations with Almighty Allah, there seems to be no form more powerful and effective than love in consolidating the relation of a servant with the Almighty Allah. A comparison between the elements which make up the relation with Almighty Allah has appeared in different Islamic traditions. We will have a look at some of these traditions in this and also the next episodes to have a general understanding of the difference between these elements, between these different paths, actually, of reaching the Almighty Allah. For instance, it is narrated that Allah the Exalted revealed to Prophet Dawood, saying, O Dawood, my remembrance is for those who remember me. My paradise is for the obedient ones. And my love, or hub, is for those who yearn for me, mushtaqeen. While I am specially for the lovers, I am only for those who are muhibbeen, for those who truly love me. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We will try to discuss more in this about this concept in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقول لك احبك يا شعبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
With only 64 X-ray and 73 kidney dialysis machines, 7 CT scanners and 1 MRI, combined with West cruel sanctions against the quake-hit Syrians, doctors in northwest Syria are racing against the clock to treat 8,500 injuries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria on February 6th has killed more than 50,000 people and flattened multiple cities. More than 4,500 of those who died and 8,500 injured are in northwest Syria. Its already depleted healthcare system, 4.7 million people share just one MRI machine, is on its knees. More than 10,000 buildings are completely or partially destroyed, leaving 11,000 people homeless, according to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA. The earthquake also destroyed warehouses that store medicines. Hospitals in this region have been overwhelmed as they attempt to accommodate thousands of injured people in spaces with severely limited beds, medical supplies, surgical equipment, and intensive care facilities. More than 8,500 injured people need to be accommodated in only 66 functional hospitals, providing 1,245 beds for short hospital stays, according to the WHO. Moreover, all of northwest Syria has just 86 orthopedic surgeons, 64 X-ray machines, 7 computerized tomography, CT scanners, and 1 magnetic resonance imaging MRI machine across the region. According to WHO, compiled data published towards the end of 2022. The region's critical lack of health care is partly caused by hospitals and medical staff being targeted during the war, explains Ek Zayes, who is a co-investigator on a UK-funded project called Research for Health System Strengthening in Syria. In a separate study, Zayes estimated that as of June 2021, 350 medical facilities had been attacked and 930 healthcare personnel killed. AKS says people are running all over the place to make use of any existing resources, including basic ambulances. The medical staff have been working nonstop, adds Habusa, who is working at the maternity hospital in Idlib when the first earthquake hit at 1:17 universal time. The hospital occupies the 5th and 6th floors of a building. Habusa said, "We had to evacuate the incubators and move all the babies to the ground floor." According to 3 doctors who Nature spoke to in northwest Syria, The most common injuries are limb fractures, trauma injuries, crush injuries, including crush syndrome, damages that result in organ dysfunction, including kidney failure and bleeding. People with crush syndrome need intensive care and dialysis, says cardiologist Jawad Abu Hattab, who is Dean of Medicine at Aleppo University in northwest Syria. However, the region has only 73 renal dialysis machines, according to the WHO compiled data. Abu Hattab adds there were also cases of cardiac arrest from the shock and horror of catastrophe. The medical community is also preparing to deal with more cases of post-earthquake trauma, especially among children and women. Doctors say they urgently need more dialysis machines and orthopedic surgery equipment, along with painkillers and antibiotics. These supplies were not abundant before the earthquake and will now run out, says Habusha. Truthout wrote in this regard, the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed many people. The destruction is unfathomable. According to the UN, at least 870,000 people across Turkey and Syria are in urgent need of hot meals. In Syria, around 5.3 million people are in need of shelter. And over 1 million people in Turkey are living in temporary shelters. It feels like another punch in the gut after the horrors and anguish Syrians have already endured through years of war, displacement, and sanctions. Heartbreaking stories have emerged from Turkey and Syria. In one widely shared image, photographer Adam Alton memorialized the anguish of a father as he sat alone amidst the rubble holding onto his deceased 15-year-old daughter's hand. Stories of rescue have also ignited flickers of hope amid such profound despair. The earthquake is the latest crisis within a larger crisis in Syria, already fractured over a decade now. Over 300,000 people have been killed there since the war broke out in 2011. Prior to the earthquake, an estimated 6.7 million people were already internally displaced. Millions more were impoverished by U.S. and European sanctions designed to strangle the economy. Additional U.S. sanctions since 2020 have targeted key sectors, including the central bank, oil, energy, and construction. They have also blocked food, medicine, medical equipment, and other necessities. 90% of Syrians now live in poverty, and 12 million are food insecure. With more than half of Syria's infrastructure either destroyed or severely damaged by war, sanctions have made reconstruction and economic recovery impossible. This was the situation before the earthquake struck. Months earlier, UN envoy Alina Duhan called for an end to sanctions, saying, "I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction," she said. Her recommendation has even greater urgency today. In a de facto admission that sanctions are hurting civilians, the U.S. Department of Treasury recently agreed to open a 180-day window authorizing transactions related to earthquake relief efforts in Syria. Although a welcome development, it's only a short-term reprieve from the sanctions' far-reaching catastrophic impacts. For the U.S., maintaining these failed sanctions while pledging to be a partner to the people of Syria is contradictory and counterproductive. They should be permanently lifted to allow Syrians the chance to finally catch their breath and begin to rebuild from these crises with dignity. The U.S. and international community must also redouble their diplomatic efforts toward ending the war instead of prolonging it. Tragedy should transcend political divisions, not reinforce them. According to RT, the effects of the devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake, which hit both Turkey and Russia earlier this month, are being compounded by Western sanctions. But despite a temporary relaxation of restrictions on the war-torn and shaken country, problems still exist. Syrian provinces have still been left ill-prepared to deal with the scale of disaster that has befallen them and must now be given every support to reconstruct their country. According to the authorities in Turkey and Syria, as many as 50,000 people have been killed by the devastating earthquake, with at least 23 million people affected in total. Millions have been temporarily displaced, and many more still await news on their loved ones and whether or not they survive. The situation, as it stands, is another utter disaster, and the full impact is impossible to convey in mere words. In Turkey's case, the international community's response was unanimous. Aid was pledged, teams arrived to relieve the suffering, and whatever the political frictions between Istanbul and some Western nations, a sense of universal humanitarian camaraderie prevailed. The Biden administration in Washington reacted to the natural disaster by pledging anything that Ankara needed, while the European Union mobilized emergency response and offered its Copernicus satellite mapping service to help first responders in Turkey. However, the situation has been very different for Syria, with only a few select nations quick to come to its aid. The U.S. regime stated that it would not cooperate with Damascus to deal with the carnage inside Syrian territory. The Syrian government officially requested help from EU, which some EU states instantly refused to provide. The UK quickly came to aid of their NATO ally, Turkey, but refused help to the suffering Syrians. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted his condolences to Turkey and his people in Turkish, but failed to acknowledge Syria at all. Syrians were not in the spotlight to receive help from the West and are actively being ignored, in spite of the gravity of the situation facing them.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.